Chapter 15, The History of a Depressive. Terry de la Mare was 10 years younger than me, and like me, he was a Londoner, born and bred. On the Spears side, he was partly of Huguenot descent, his father being a nephew of the poet Walter de la Mare, who had died as recently as 1956, but whom Terry had never met. More than once I wondered what would have happened had the two been able to meet, and whether the aged author of The Listeners and Peacock Pie would have understood his sensitive great-nephew. Terry's father clearly did not understand him any more than his hypochondriacal mother did. A butcher by trade and a Freemason who had once had the honour of welcoming a member of the royal family to his lodge, he was a stern, harsh man of decidedly Victorian views, who believed that to spare the rod was to spoil the child, and the rod had certainly not been spared in Terry's case, either literally or metaphorically. One of Terry's earliest memories was of his father catching him, at the age of 3, playing with another little boy, and thrashing him, in the interests of his morals, very severely. Whether he told me about the incident in the course of our first talk, I do not remember, but I know he spoke of it, whether then or later, on only one occasion, probably because the subject was so painful. This thrashing may have prevented him from making friends with other boys at school. An only child, he grew up lonely, anxious and withdrawn, his main concern being to guard himself against the encroachments of the outside world. Not that he could guard himself against those encroachments completely. In particular, he could not guard himself against them on Saturday mornings, when he had to help his father in the shop. The smell of blood and the sight of carcasses and sections of carcasses hanging up was bad enough. What was worse was the fact that his own special job was to kill the rabbits. If Terry did not speak of his school life, and I do not remember him speaking of it even once, uncongenial as this must have been, it probably was because the unhappiness of weekdays was quite eclipsed in his memory by the horror of those Saturday mornings about which he spoke several times. He hated having to kill the rabbits, but was much too afraid of his father to refuse to do the work or even to think of refusing. Once, when we had known each other for 2 or 3 years, I suggested he try writing about the rabbits and how he felt about having to kill them, as writing could have a cathartic effect. And he eventually made the attempt. It was not very successful. After describing how before killing the rabbits he had cuddled and talked to them, telling them how sorry he was and trying to soothe their fears, he broke out in a cold sweat and started trembling and shaking so violently that he had to stop. The strength of his reaction was hardly surprising. He had been shown how to kill rabbits when he was 10 or 11 and had carried on killing them week after week, except when on holiday with his parents at the seaside, until well into his teens. Naturally, the experience of having to do something so utterly repugnant to his feelings and having to do it repeatedly for so many years traumatised him deeply. But of this his parents knew nothing. They were quite oblivious to the fact that, quote, a soul raged in their child. A soul which, being unable to communicate the pain it felt or even to grasp it consciously, simply shrank back into itself. Quiet and obedient and physically healthy, Terry gave them no trouble, and they assumed he was happy. When, years later, as a man of 33, he tried to tell them in a carefully worded letter that his childhood had not been a happy one, they were incredulous, and his mother wrote back, saying, inter alia, "We always thought we three got on so well together." According to their lights, they had been good parents. Terry had always been well-fed and well-clothed and had, in fact, wanted for nothing, and they were puzzled to think what had gone wrong. Having to kill rabbits on Saturday mornings was not the only cause of Terry's later resentments against his parents, though it was perhaps the most important one. He was also bitter because they had allowed him to leave school at 15. His bitterness was due not so much to his having liked school as to his conviction that, having received only an elementary education, he was at a serious disadvantage when mixing with people more educated and knowledgeable than himself, whether at his place of work or socially. Such people made him feel inferior and inadequate, and therefore nervous and tongue-tied. Terry's place of work, at the time we met, was the new Bond Street office of a well-known advertising agency. How he had managed to get into the highly competitive world of commercial advertising, then as popular a career choice for ambitious young men as television and computing would be in future years, he never thought it worthwhile to tell me. But I gather that his having been good at art when at school had opened a door. Once in the advertising world, he had stayed in it, and without actually reaching the top of the tree, had done quite well, eventually joining his present firm and becoming a chief designer there. The reason for his success, he believed, was that unlike some designers, he did not think of himself as an artist manqué, and did not try to be creative. He simply followed the client's instructions. Much of his work was concerned with motor vehicles, especially trucks, and his photographs of the latest model appeared regularly on the front covers of leading trade magazines. There had only been one interruption to his career. This was when he was doing his 2 years national service, an experience that did him no harm and perhaps some good. He worked in the company office, was popular with his colleagues, and was away from the repressive and deadening influence of home. A year after leaving the army, when he was 21 and back at work, he married the daughter of a Jewish solicitor. They had a church wedding, and her father gave them, as a wedding present, two houses in northwest London, one to live in and one as a source of income. Terry never told me how he had met Gillian, or why he had chosen to marry her rather than any of the other women he knew, though I gathered that he had not been in love. What he did tell me more than once was that he had thought of marriage. What he did tell me more than once was what he had thought marriage would be like. It would be like living in paradise. Indeed, it would be paradise itself. It would be a supremely blissful state of perfect harmony and fulfilment that left nothing further to be desired. How he had arrived at such a conception of marriage was not clear. He could hardly have believed his parents to be living in paradise, unless he was as ignorant of their real feelings as they were of his. And it is unlikely that he had been influenced by Renaissance love poetry like that of Spenser, or, at the other end of the literary scale, by modern popular romantic fiction like that of Barbara Cartland. Tennyson claimed that the peace of God came into his life when he was married, and Dean Inge made a similar claim. Both men married when they were over 40, after a lifetime of celibacy, and the peace of which they spoke evidently was not St. Paul's peace of God, which passeth all understanding, but the peace of sexual fulfilment after a long period of abstinence and frustration. In Terry's case, there had been no such period of frustration, and the peace Tennyson and the gloomy Dean claimed to have experienced did not enter into his life at this time. Marriage nevertheless brought him a measure of sexual fulfilment. Gillian had been his first girlfriend. Though he had never responded to women in a purely physical way, and considered himself to be lacking in male aggressiveness. The fulfilment, such as it was, proved to be short-lived. Terry soon discovered that Gillian was a very frigid woman who found sex distasteful and who regarded copulation as an unpleasant marital duty to be got over as quickly as possible. The discovery left him more emotionally traumatised than ever. He was unable to give free rein to his feelings, and sexual intercourse, never satisfactory, became a repulsive and degrading exercise that brought on headaches and a feeling of stuffiness that gave him what he called a cotton wool mind. Gillian herself he eventually came to despise. Though a nice person and an excellent housewife, she was naive, with many adolescent enthusiasms, and no more capable of responding to him intellectually than she was of responding sexually. That Terry should have realised this so late in the day suggests that he could not have known Gillian very well before their marriage, and had, perhaps, been so convinced of the paradisal nature of marriage as to think that who one was actually married to hardly mattered. However that might have been, for Terry, domestic life was becoming unbearable. He and Gillian never argued. Perhaps it would have been better had they done so. Between them lay what has been called the silence of marriage, a silence not of mutual understanding, but of mutual estrangement. To make matters worse, Gillian was pregnant, and when the child came, Terry felt more tied down than ever. So tied down did he feel that his attitude towards the new arrival was one of indifference, though later he grew very fond of his little daughter. Not only did he feel tied down, he felt he was spending the best years of his life simply dissipating his energies, besides which he realised how emotionally and intellectually deprived he had been as a teenager, and how lacking in friendship, and how lacking in freedom. Eventually, he came to loathe everything connected with marriage and the home. In deciding to get married, he concluded bitterly, he had acted immaturely and was now having to suffer the consequences. At this juncture, he encountered Vivian, a Chilean girl who also worked in advertising. Though in his position she lacked the capacity to be creative or original, he found talking nonsense with her, as he termed their light-hearted exchanges, a pleasant relaxation from his debilitating everyday experiences. Just when the friendship developed into a sexual relationship, whether shortly before or shortly after Terry left his wife, I do not know. But at the time he and I met, Vivian was still his girlfriend, though they did not live together and apparently had never done so. Perhaps it was not without significance that the first time I saw her sitting primly beside Terry at one of my Sunday afternoon lectures, I was uncertain if she was his wife or his sister. Despite her South American origins, she was light-complexioned, with auburn hair, cold blue eyes, and full flushed cheeks. And though she was slightly built and small in the waist, when she stood, one saw that her legs were remarkably thick, almost like tree trunks. If his friendship with her had turned into a sexual relationship while he was still living with Gillian, Terry must have felt extremely guilty, for he certainly felt guilty about it after leaving the marital home, and continued to do so for some time. In his own eyes, he was committing adultery, and adultery, he had been brought up to believe, was a sin. Divorce was unthinkable. It was therefore with some trepidation that he eventually told his parents that his marriage had broken down irretrievably, and that he and Gillian were thinking the unthinkable. Though shocked and upset beyond measure, they were in no doubt as to who was to blame for the catastrophe. The culprit was Vivian. She was the fatal other woman who had wrecked their son's marriage, and no words were too bad for her. Thereafter, she was always that South American bitch, or simply that bitch, and they refused to meet her. So far as Terry was concerned, Vivian was only a minor factor in the breakdown of his marriage, but he could not tell his parents this without telling them what the major factors were, and this it was psychologically impossible for him to do. He could not speak of the chronic emotional frustration he had experienced with Gillian. Sex had always been a taboo subject at home, nor could he tell them of the revelation that had finally brought matters to a head. The revelation had come without warning, like a flash of lightning from a clear sky. There was a telephone call from Gillian to Derek at the office, as a result of which Terry was told that the two of them were having an affair. Derek was not only Terry's colleague, he was his best, in fact his only friend, the only friend he'd ever had, and he owed a lot to him. It was Derek who had taught him how to handle money. Derek, whose influence had made him less self-conscious in social situations. Derek, who had helped him get through many a bad weekend. And now, Terry felt, in his own phrase, that everything had been blown sky high. At the same time, he felt free. Free to tell Gillian about Vivian, and free to see Vivian herself as often as he wanted. The fact that he was free to see Vivian as often as he wanted did not mean that all was well. On the conscious level, he had no qualms about seeing her. But deep down, it was another story, and each morning he woke exhausted by the conflict. He was particularly concerned for the future of his daughter Fiona, now 3 years old. And though annoyed with Gillian for her foolishness, he used no stronger term, in becoming involved with Derek, he therefore felt obliged to point out the implications for both her and the child of the situation in which she had landed herself. Derek was loose-living and erratic, as he well knew, and it was unlikely that she would be able to rely on him for long. With Derek, to whom he still felt a basic loyalty, he was no less frank, warning him what he had to look forward to where Gillian was concerned. Derek soon found this out for himself. Within a few months, he was complaining to Terry about Gillian's lack of individuality and the way her views fluctuated. Before long, the wretched affair was over. For some time afterwards, Terry was undecided what to do. Life was proving too much for him, and initially he was tempted to creep back into the shell from which, with Derek's help, he had emerged not many years earlier. But he resisted the temptation. Instead of withdrawing, he would, on the contrary, face the problems that had arisen and try to understand them. The biggest of these problems was his continued lack of sexual responsiveness. In fact, the problem haunted him, and, convinced that unless it was sorted out, his emotions could not be unblocked, he sought the advice of Dr. David Cooper, an associate of R.D. Lang. Cooper, with whom he was to be in contact on and off for the rest of his life, advised him to postpone any decisions. This advice Terry had rejected. Far from postponing any decisions, he had proceeded to abandon all interests and activities other than his job, had stopped trying to patch up his marriage, and finally had broken to his parents the news that he and Julian were thinking of getting divorced. The next 4 years, the years immediately preceding his appearance at my lecture on Buddhism and the problem of death, was a period of psychological exploration and adjustment, mystical experience, and widening intellectual horizons. Psychological exploration took place at the London Clinic of Psychoanalysis, to which David Cooper had given him a referral. He was a patient of the clinic for 2.5 years, attending each day for 50 minutes, 5 days a week, except when on holiday, and paying 8 shillings a session for treatment. As the clinic was situated in New Cavendish Street, he was able to get there in the morning on his way to work. Psychoanalysis freed him up sexually and in consequence emotionally too, to an extent, and he ceased to suffer from a lack of sexual responsiveness. But sex was not everything, and in any case, even at its most satisfactory, he never experienced the erotic glow he had sometimes felt as a child. When he had been attending the London clinic for 2.5 years, he therefore again sought the advice of David Cooper, who this time recommended that he become a short-term patient at Villa 21. Villa 21 was an experimental therapeutic unit for young schizophrenic patients at the Frearn Mental Hospital, just northwest of London. Cooper had started the unit in 1962. It lasted until 1966. and it was experimental in the sense that it dealt with schizophrenic patients according to the family-oriented ideology of R.D. Lang and A. Esterson. That he should have thought Terry might benefit from the treatment in the unit did not mean that he regarded him as suffering from schizophrenia, but only that he thought he exhibited some of the characteristics on account of which a person was labelled as schizophrenic by his family and members of the medical profession. For Cooper, such terms as schizophrenic, patient, and treatment were mentally to be placed within single inverted commas, and in a book published in 1971, he was to define schizophrenia as, quote, a micro-social crisis situation in which the acts and experience of a certain person are invalidated by others for certain intelligible cultural and microcultural, usually familial, reasons, to the point where he is elected and identified as being, quote, mentally ill in a certain way, and is then confirmed by a specific but highly arbitrary labelling process in the identity, quote, schizophrenic patient, by medical and quasi-medical agents. Terry's parents may not have actually labelled him a schizophrenic, but they certainly regarded his evident dislike of what he called the stereotyped living of suburbia as a sign of mental illness, or at least of there being something seriously wrong with him. The treatment Terry was given at Villa 21 was simple and, in a sense, drastic. He was given ether. There were two sessions, and on both occasions the ether was administered by a certain Dr. Capel. As he wrote shortly afterwards, quote, as Dr. Capel administered the ether, so my mind seemed to ascend one level of understanding after another. Time was the first fiction to be exposed, coupled with the crippling effects that personality has upon a person's true self. As my awareness increased, the frequency at which my mind seemed to function was fantastic, and in contrast to that of my surroundings. I was irritated by Dr. Capel's ignorance of my experience, and longed for her to stop questioning me, as it was time-consuming and inane. I became reluctant to talk, and wished only for silence. End of quote. Presently he transcended time, and the feeling he had was one of exquisite fineness, a fineness he at one stage described as the point of the point of the point of a needle. Yet knowing that there was the climax of no point still to come, he waited and observed, whereupon he experienced a sensation of standing in pure knowledge, a moment of total comprehension that represented a human being's perfect and total development. But even this moment of no point contained a subtle experience of knowing. It therefore was not the ultimate experience, which was, but what it was, Terry was never able to say. Or rather, he gave different accounts of it at different times. It was a state of total oblivion, a fluorescent darkness, a description that reminded me of Dionysius the Areopagite's deep but dazzling darkness, and even on one occasion an experience of being back in the womb. In his discussions with me, he usually spoke of it, borrowing the language of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, with which he seemed to have been familiar even before meeting me, as the pure white light, or more simply, as the ether experience, or ether abreaction. At both of his two sessions of treatment, the experiences Terry underwent followed much the same pattern. On both occasions, ether having been administered, there was the same immediate rapid ascent through successively more refined levels of consciousness, and on both occasions, unfortunately, the same irritating questioning by Dr. Capel. At one point in the second session, he was so exasperated by her continual bombardment that he decided to satisfy, for a moment, her desire that he should become aggressive, and in the course of so doing demonstrated, presumably in relation to the attendants who were restraining him, incredible strength. Having thus dispensed what he termed the appropriate shock treatment, he returned to lying on his back and allowed the process of ascent to continue. At no stage of the ascent, on either that or the previous occasion, were there any LSD-type visionary experiences, and on both occasions, the climactic moment, the moment of total oblivion, occurred simultaneously with the descent back into ordinary consciousness. The moment of death was also the moment of birth. But despite his having returned to ordinary consciousness, it seemed to him, again on both occasions, that silence was imperative, and he attempted to remain quite mute. At the same time, coupled with a feeling of detachment and serenity, there was an intense love for and understanding of all the people around him, including the insensitive and talkative Dr. Capel. The ether experience had a permanent effect on Terry's thinking. It left him convinced that for human beings there were two possible approaches to reality. They could either develop an understanding of themselves and their environment over scores of lifetimes, and experience reality as the reward of their creative effort to evolve, or they could simply see that the truth, pure and unadulterated, was and always had been available, and that it, moreover, was capable of being experienced here and now, whether by means of fasting or meditating, or as the result of a drug abreaction such as he had undergone. He also realized that in the course of a lifetime, a human being had to put in what seemed an unbelievable amount of effort and discipline, and that this, quote, hideous self-imposed struggle, he found so upsetting, when recovering after his first session of treatment, that he burst into tears. He also felt compelled to tell Dr. Capel in this connection that she could not help him, for while her drugs were extremely potent, he now knew that for him the best psychotherapy was a prolonged and sincere attempt to dispel the clouds that were obscuring the pure light of the mind. That attempt could not be made in an ideological vacuum. It had to be made within the context of a particular philosophy, and with the help of that philosophy's special disciplines. Terry therefore started attending the meetings of a number of different organisations, from the Fabian Society to the Personalist Group, and from the Gurdjieff Society to the College of Psychic Science. He did not look for what he was seeking in any of the Christian churches, nor did it ever occur to him to look for it there. This was partly because he had not been brought up to be religious. His parents, though puritanical, had no time for religion, and partly because conventional Christian piety nauseated him. Even after he had come to regard himself as a Buddhist, he saw Buddhism as a philosophy rather than as a religion, and though by no means lacking in a spirit of reverence, a phrenologist would have said that his bump of reverence was a big one, he was disinclined to join in acts of corporate worship, such as pujas. The organisation whose meetings Terry attended most regularly and whose teachings he took most seriously during the difficult time that followed his ether experience was the School of Economic Science. In the summer of 1965, when our paths started to converge, he was still attending classes at its premises in the Haymarket. He was to attend them until the end of the year. And in the early days of our friendship, the organisation and its teachings was one of the topics of discussion between us. I knew nothing about the School of Economic Science, though the name was quite familiar to me. Like many others, I had seen on the walls of various London Underground stations, usually from the other side of the track, while waiting for the train to come in, the big black and white posters advertising the school's courses. Later I learned it was the front organisation, so to speak, for a curious amalgam of Western esotericism and Brahminical Advaita Vedanta. The Western esotericism derived from one of the numerous Gurdjieff Uspensky splinter groups, while the Brahminical Advaita Vedanta, derived from the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and subsequently from Swami Shantananda Sarasvati, one of the four principal Shankaracharyas and a fellow disciple of the Maharishi. The school's teachings were therefore sufficiently broad, not to say eclectic. Students, moreover, were encouraged to read the philosophical and religious classics of both East and West. In particular, it seems, they were encouraged to read Plato, and Terry was already familiar with several of the dialogues, including The Republic. Contact with the School of Economic Science had, in fact, widened his intellectual horizons, and he had much to be thankful to it for. But much was not everything. There was still something lacking, which was why he had started coming to my lectures at the College of Psychic Science.